This is Pittsburgh Explainer from 90.5 WESA. Every Friday, we help you understand some of the most important news stories from southwestern Pennsylvania. It's Friday, June 12th. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Liz Reed. There's a discussion happening in Pittsburgh and around the country about the ways we as a society think about policing. People are questioning whether armed officers are the ones who should be handling issues of mental illness, domestic disputes, and broken taillights. The idea of diverting resources away from police departments and toward other social services has suddenly entered the mainstream. Minneapolis City Council is making moves to completely disband that city's police department. In Pittsburgh, the proposals have been more measured, including an effort to end the use of what are called less lethal weapons for crowd control at protests. Here to explain more is government and accountability reporter Anlie Herring. Anlie, thanks for being on the show this week.
Thanks for having me.
What are, quote, less lethal weapons? What does that mean?
A lot of examples that people would have in mind when they think about what these things are rubber bullets or tear gas or flashbang grenades. And flashbang grenades, they emit a bright light and noise when officers kind of throw them into a crowd to try to disorient people and get a crowd to disperse. And they're called less lethal because they actually were previously called non-lethal, but evidence has shown that they can cause death if they hit a sensitive area on a person's body, like their head or their throat, or if someone has pre-existing medical conditions that put them at a higher risk. But by and large, law enforcement uses them in order to control crowds whenever they consider there to be civil unrest that has turned violent or dangerous or has the potential to. And from law enforcement's perspective, and this is written into the Pittsburgh Police Bureau policy, it's considered a more efficient and humane way to disperse and control a crowd.
What do you know about the origins of this class of weapons?
I spoke with Bob Swartzwelder. He's the president of the Pittsburgh Fraternal Order of Police Union, and he's a use of force expert. And he said that going back to the 1960s, law enforcement started to use this technology, and over time it has evolved. So rubber bullets, actually, although that's something that people hear a lot and think are being used in local protests, those actually are a pretty outdated form of less lethal weaponry, and they're not used today. What's used today are beanbag rounds. That's like a cloth bag that is full of lead pellets, or Swartzwelder said silica sand, and they do cause significant impact when they're shot at protesters and can cause some real serious bruising, and if they hit the wrong body part, they can cause brain damage or eye damage. So that's why Swartzwelder says it's really important that police be trained in how to use these tools. And he says that that training does happen within the Pittsburgh Police Department.
Help me understand what these weapons are supposed to do. The idea would be, I suppose, to sort of scare people into dispersing. Like if there's a cloud of this gas that can cause respiratory distress, the police are expecting that you would leave the area to avoid that respiratory distress. Am I understanding this correctly?
Well, the purpose of these weapons would depend on how far along in a confrontation you are. Swartzwelder explained to me that they take a progressive approach in using this whole class of munitions. So they will issue verbal warnings saying this is an unlawful assembly, you must disperse. And if demonstrators don't heed those orders, then police officers could release smoke. If demonstrators still don't disperse, then officers could start to use the pepper spray and then eventually use the what are called kinetic impact methods, such as those beanbag rounds. So initially, the idea is to create that threat and to try to get protesters to leave. If that doesn't happen, then the police do intend to cause pain. I mean, the definition of these weapons is that they can cause pain, severe discomfort, although in most situations, they won't cause death.
This week, Allegheny County Councilors Bethany Hallam and Liv Bennett introduced a bill to ban many of these less lethal weapons. What is their argument?
They say that these weapons are simply too risky and dangerous. And Liv Bennett also said they're an example of how our police forces are militarized, even though the weapons are not meant to be fatal. So they say that it's just too high a risk and they shouldn't be used by police against citizens who are exercising their First Amendment rights to assemble and protest.
What are the odds of this bill actually passing in county council? Like, what's the sort of political environment there?
Both Bennett and Hallam were pretty frank that they don't think that this bill has the best prospects. They both said just given the membership of council, it is unlikely that it would become law. Council is predominantly Democratic. Only 3 of the 15 members are Republicans. Yet a good number of the Democrats are fairly moderate. And even so, it's fair to say that this is a progressive measure that Hallam and Bennett are putting forth. So I think that a lot of people would just consider it to be too radical. Although there are a few jurisdictions in the country that are banning these weapons, at least on a temporary basis. A court in Denver actually upheld a ban after it faced a legal challenge recently. That ban would be a temporary one at this point. And Seattle also had a ban in the works this week.
Anlie, thanks so much for your reporting.
Thank you.
It's time for a quick break. We'll be right back.
Want more local news but don't have the time or, frankly, the desire to comb through all the headlines? Let us do it for you. Sign up for our daily newsletter, Inbox Edition, and get the stories you need to start your day delivered right to your inbox. Sign up at wesa.fm/inboxedition.
This week, Pittsburgh City Councilor Ricky Burgess introduced several pieces of legislation aimed at changing policing in the city of Pittsburgh. Government and accountability reporter Ariel Worthy joins me now to discuss the bills. Welcome, Ariel.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So can you just start by explaining what these proposals are and what they would do?
Yeah, so he actually introduced 4 pieces of legislation on Tuesday. The first would put a hiring freeze on police right now. The second would actually take $250,000 from police salaries and put it towards a violence prevention initiative. The third would actually prohibit the city from buying military equipment and weaponry. And the fourth would require an officer, if they see another officer violating someone's rights or using inappropriate force, to actually step in and stop that officer. And there was actually a fifth one, but it was introduced by Bruce Krause. And it was actually for the city and the police review board to partner with a third party to look at police use of force and just community and police relations here in Pittsburgh.
What was the conversation like around these proposals among city council members?
Burgess, you know, he is one of 2 Black councilors and Krause is a white man. So when they talked about Krause's bill, it actually got quite tense. Burgess actually he called the bills actually silly and frivolous and said that there was no need for a third party to tell the city about the racism that goes on in the police department here. He also said some things about it's about time that Krause started caring for communities of color. And there was a lot of back and forth around that conversation.
One of the bills you mentioned would put $250,000 into a violence prevention fund. I don't off the top of my head have the police bureau's budget, but that doesn't sound like a lot of money.
It's not. So the budget is $114 million for 2020. So that's a very small amount. In fact, there were several people who called in for the public speaking portion of the meeting, and they actually said that $250,000 was not enough money.
As a former city council reporter for this very newsroom, I know that one of the most interesting things about these meetings is often the public comment. So what else were people saying during this week's meeting?
There were actually a higher than usual amount of people speaking at this meeting, and all of them were about police reform. Here's a few of those people. The first person you'll hear speaking is Douglas Weaver, and he is a Pittsburgh firefighter.
from car accidents where drivers are agitated to calls for mental health crises. I can't tell you how many times I've witnessed PBP officers resort immediately to use of tasers and physical restraint without ever even trying to verbally calm someone down.
It's abundantly clear that reform alone is not enough to address both structural racism and excessive use of force within the department, nor would I argue that such limited budgetary changes are enough on their own either.
Can you not look at this city and see that we are begging for systemic change? We don't want tiny half measures.
Reforming and even defunding the police is not a goal in itself. What would it mean for the city to divest from systemic racism in general?
So in addition to Douglas Weaver, we also heard from Alexandria Allen, Jennifer Yoder, and Noah Terrio.
It sounds like people in general are actually not satisfied with these measures that Burgess and Krause introduced.
Some people, they kind of felt like it was a good first start, but it needs to go further. They thought that $250,000 was not enough. There needed to be more money taken from police salaries and just from their overall budget and put into the communities themselves, and in particular, Black and brown communities.
Now, in Minneapolis, we're seeing efforts by the city council to actually dismantle that city's police department. I mean, did city council broach that topic at all this week?
For a brief moment, they actually talked about the police and the whole thought of disbanding them, basically. One thing that the council president, Teresa Kale Smith, brought up was that, you know, these are people who are still part of the communities. They still are hardworking people, and to not generalize all of them. So her overall thing was that disbanding the police is not the right move, but there should be some form of police reform.
Errol, I look forward to hearing more about these bills and these efforts as they develop. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's time for a quick break. Stay with us.
We've Got the Beat is the new 80s show from our sister station, 91.3 WYEP. Thursdays from 10 p.m. to midnight, host Bob Studebaker plays favorites from the decade that brought us post-punk, new wave, and synth-pop. Listen on air at WYEP.org or tell your smart speaker to play WYEP.
If you live in Pittsburgh, you've probably seen people posting on social media about this huge mural along the Allegheny River across from PNC Park that says Black Lives Matter. The sentiment itself is less controversial than the story behind the mural. To explain, I'm happy to welcome WESA's arts and culture reporter Bill O'Driscoll. Bill, thanks for being on the show.
Sure thing, Liz.
Can you just start by explaining how the mural came about?
Yeah, on Saturday, this past Saturday, a group of street artists got together. There was about six of them, I understand. They wanted to contribute somehow to support the message of the folks who were protesting against police brutality. So they set out down to the space where a mural had been painted in 2015, and they painted over this mural. It's on the Allegheny Wharf, and they started to paint these letters 12 feet high or so that say Black Lives Matter.
Why was there controversy around this mural?
Well, the main controversy revolved around the fact that none of the artists in this group who painted the mural was actually Black. They were white artists, primarily. Once the social media, as you pointed out, started to circulate, you know, it got a lot of approval because people were behind the message, but then it surfaced that none of the artists was Black, and some folks in the local community objected to that. I don't know if it was hijacking the message exactly, but they felt like if there were going to be artists making this statement, there should be at least some involvement by Black artists.
What did the people behind the mural say in response to those criticisms?
I spoke to Joshua Kranick, who was one of the artists who initially painted this, and he said, you know, we were working with the resources we had, we were working with people that we knew, and also he said they didn't want to expose anyone potentially to getting arrested or to bad treatment by police, the implication being that they felt as white artists, they would be sort of safer and in a way kind of using their privilege as white artists. The fact that the police showed up while these guys were there on Saturday in broad daylight painting these 12-foot-high letters, the police had gotten a call from someone. Joshua Kranick told me the police simply showed up, took the information, and then left. Didn't ask him to stop, certainly didn't arrest or harass anyone. It's a fair question to ask whether if this had been a group of black artists or even mostly black artists doing this, if they would have gotten the same cooperation.
I can't help but think back to the controversy back in 2018 when Alicia B. Wormsley put up her billboard in East Liberty saying, "There are black people in the future." Is there a thread between these two pieces of public art?
There are important differences between the two projects. One, Alicia's piece was completely legal and sanctioned. It was part of an art project that she was doing with a Carnegie Mellon art professor named John Rubin. He had the cooperation of the building's owner to do these messages. It was only after some unnamed person or persons in the community complained about the message, "There are black people in the future," that the building owner felt pressure to remove it. It wasn't an unsanctioned artwork, but I mean, certainly you can see parallels here, important parallels in the message, in that these sort of pro-black messages, if they're put forth by black artists, it seems that, yeah, if you take Alicia's case, that there was a lot of pressure there.
It also makes me wonder if Wormsley had put up that billboard today, would it be received differently now that this sentiment of Black Lives Matter is becoming so widespread? You have corporations all over the country and the world putting out public statements saying Black Lives Matter. It's no longer a fringe opinion or even a political opinion in a sense.
Yeah, this is, you know, a more widespread sentiment than it used to be. Also, we're right in the middle of ongoing and very large national and local protests whose central message is Black Lives Matter. It's very hard to imagine a city official in Pittsburgh ordering the halting or removal of a sign that says Black Lives Matter at this moment.
On Wednesday, you went down to the riverfront as black artists were adding their contributions to the mural. What did they tell you about why this was important?
I spoke to Cameron Camo Nesbitt, who was the black muralist from Pittsburgh. He comes from Homewood originally, and he works in other cities doing street art, sanctioned murals. And he just said, "We agree with the message. We just want to have more voices heard. We want to have more representation here." He's also saying this in the context of, you know, public art is seen by many critics as being a space that black artists are not permitted to contribute to as they should be. He felt that by organizing a group of black artists, he said there were about 20 who said they were going to come over the course of a day to add to this Black Lives Matter mural, by giving them an opportunity to sort of put this on their resume, if you will, that it would help increase opportunities in the future for black artists. The young artists who I spoke to a couple of them who were doing the painting down there, said, "We just want to improve this, make it more beautiful. We want to make our mark on it and kind of contribute to the conversation that way."
Bill, thanks so much for your coverage this week.
Sure thing, Liz.
That's Pittsburgh Explainer for this week. Our show is produced by Katie Blackley. Larkin Page Jacobs is our managing editor. You can find all of our news coverage at our website, WESA.FM, and of course on the air at 90.5 FM. I'm your host, Liz Reed. Thanks for listening. Let's talk next week.